This is Angle of View. Today is May 12th, 2026. I'm Will Hatman. Angle of View Classics Week 4 inaugurates a director's profile subseries. And instead of starting with a director that I particularly love, I'm going to pander again to popular taste and do a director that everybody else loves, David Fincher. We'll start with probably his most culturally significant movie, and one that only last month got a theatrical re-release, and that I conveniently wrote up very thoroughly after a random rewatch 2 years ago. Most of these others I rewatched just in the past few weeks for the first time in years, though since I was a teenaged boy in the 90s and very much counted among this director's fans, I will note that his first three movies I saw many, many times each before taking my break of decades. So many times that when I get to each one and try to note which viewing the most recent one was, it will be a guess, and it will be give or take like four. Fight Club, 1999. Review date, March 5th, 2024. Probably something like 14th viewing. It's the end of history, but you're still alive. And everything in the culture that you might consult to figure out what to do with yourself just tells you to consume products. You're an adult in what was supposed to be the prime of your life, and this is the wasteland into which your potential has been birthed. Advertising has moved beyond packaging thin fantasies of convenience and pleasure to colonize philosophy, art, love. There is no concept of personal fulfillment or of the future that hasn't already been collapsed to a product and a slogan. You're so alienated that you feel pure despair, but because you're a man and not a woman, the culture instructs you to squeeze this despair into anger. And so instead of considering the possibility that the emptiness of your daily experience and the hostility of the media environment that surrounds you might be inducing despair in everyone, you decide that it's a man thing, that men specifically are the dispossessed, the dispossession of the conquistador. And that the only way back is to band together and remind each other of what, in your idea of yourselves, distinguished you as men in the first place, your talent and fondness for violence. It's time to torch the artifices of the life you've been handed and ordered to appreciate, and boil yourself down to your most primal parts, your bare body and your killer instinct. You find the community you sought, and it feels good for a while. But then something terrible happens. It grows. Word gets out, ranks swell, more men want what you're offering. What started as an immediate experience that delivered immediate satisfaction and relief now becomes a production line, manufacturing and packaging that relief. What started as a raging rejection of a false world built on empty promises now becomes an entity making its own promises. The project's initial weakness was that it was expressly ideological. No ideology can withstand corruption while capitalism reigns, even when money isn't central to the thing. The flattening forces are at work in the culture anyway, because we're conditioned by our media environment. It will all become an advertisement. Tyler tries to stay ahead of the infection spread by continually raising the stakes on the group's objective, finally setting his sights on the total erasure of consumer debt. But everywhere he goes in the last act, he is recognized and revered. He can't pull the plug because everybody so desperately wants what he's selling that the whole thing is now self-perpetuating. They've essentially seized the means of production. Of course, this also means that his objective goes kablooey. There is nobody left to shake up and shock and wreck by your terrorism when everyone is your customer and your warrior. He codified and branded counterculture for men in a way that was so irresistibly appealing it turned into the culture. Uh-oh. Now then. Fincher's eye on all this is so slick and hard that it doesn't really offer you a way in. To let you in would be to sacrifice some control. I think such a sacrifice would have helped a movie whose story and theme were so largely about loss of control, but Fincher was never the guy to take such a thing in such a way aesthetically. You could actually persuasively argue that his approach to this tale of commodified masculinity was too commercial and too masculine to be able to dig for everything inside it, which is kind of a shame, though he would probably say that the unforgiving, rotten plastic look was an instantiation of the amorphous and invulnerable system. But he understands the physical excitement and the humor, which is enough to put the message over. And based on Jim Uhl's screenplay, the message was meant to be front and center anyway. It's a lot crisper than Chuck Palahniuk's novel, the language intentionally shaped to match the way ads and propaganda speak. And this is a smart approach to a movie version. It was startlingly resonant at the time, and however rooted in the culture of the late 90s it is, and however trite it sounds to say this, it does in many ways seem more resonant now, in the age of alpha male YouTube charlatans, proving the terrible size and shape of the demands of young men in the marketplace of ideas, and in how much worse and more futureless everything all seems now, another generation out. 7. 1995. Review date April 24th, 2026. Probably something like 14th viewing. It's exactly the movie it was 30 years ago. The serial killer procedural so transgressive and stylish and atmospherically upsetting that it crossed over from thriller into horror, which few other murder mystery movies have ever managed to do. What we could not have known then was just how widely it would be ripped off by inferior movies of the same dark and edgy stripe, not just the profusion of other serial killer movies in its immediate wake, half of which went ahead and cast Morgan Freeman, but even, e.g., The Dark Knight, which also had the bad guy turn himself in with a whole active movie left to go. It's always been a strongly above-average movie, though, and its strength is in its scenarios and images, which are about as grisly as anything that had been seen in a mainstream movie. Its weaknesses were also clear from the start. It goes flat and mechanical once Kevin Spacey has emerged and taken overt control of everything, and the ending remains bad, not least because Brad Pitt is 0% up to it. Something I had forgotten, though, or maybe never realized when I was younger, is that there are a number of dialogue scenes, mostly between our two detectives, Somerset and Mills, that really are good and do critically important characterization work, like the one in the squad car where Mills can't remember the name of the cop who died in the ambulance right next to him, or the patient, drawn-out comedy of the scene in the shared office where Mills finds out from Somerset that Tracy has invited him to dinner. The misery of the ending hurts all the more because we got to know these people rather well, got to see their flaws and the limits of their understanding, and even got to see them a little cheerful at one point. I don't think the philosophical material in the movie fully gels for how much time is spent on it, but if the prevailing idea is that our world is hell, that we are already there, despite what the sloth guy's medical examiner says, then it is dramatically compelling that the young buck cop would be led by his ego to jump in and say, "Not on my watch," while the wizened old cop would have already accepted the futility of his lot. Where this goes janky is where room is made for the killer to get involved, and where he steers things. The strategy that would tie the theme to the characters in the most interesting way would focus on the fact that Somerset and John Doe largely agree that the world is hell, but the movie doesn't squeeze this connection nearly enough. It's focused too firmly instead on making a connection between John Doe and Mills, and though there's also something there in that both men think they were put there to clean up the place, this connection empties itself when it devolves into the elaborate plot machinations of the climax. John Doe by the end has ceased to be another of Hell's soldiers, the one with the special ironic twist for extra horribleness because he thinks he's righteous, and become a cruel teacher who descended on this story to teach the young buck cop the lesson that will disabuse him of this belief in his ability to save anyone. It's an over-engineered story if ever there was one. What's funny, though, is that the same over-engineering impulse translates to the movie's direction. Fincher is John Doe, pulling the strings on everyone, yet this is still his best directorial effort, if not his best movie. The atmosphere he creates with the help of Darius Conji, director-photographer, Howard Shore, music, and a crack production design team is relentlessly amazing, his storyboarding is nearly perfect, and those distressed opening credits really were the coolest thing ever back then. He is in full command of his brilliant technique, but has not yet come to believe that the point of movies is to celebrate technique. The Game, 1997. Review date, May 9th, 2026. Probably something like 10th viewing. A movie about a wealthy man brought low that has no actual interest in class at all. Ironically, nothing could reinforce this character's power more than the idea that the entire world could be bent into a conspiracy to trick him and that it would all be for his benefit. So you have to take it a different way. It's a hilariously shallow movie, and Fincher pulls some dopey tricks that he did well to jettison afterwards. The home movies, some of which might be just memories, even though others are definitely actual home movies with people waving to the camera and whatnot. Also, critically, I ultimately can't say it's all that much fun because it feels long and dour. It's not the ideal material for Fincher's refrigerator, even though the thematic attraction is plain enough. He likes stories about control because he likes to be in control. But it is very amusing as an object, first for the shallowness in itself, and second for the way this plays into metatextual stuff about movie making and the star vehicle, which really crystallizes nicely when our hero starts picking apart the set, and then again when he walks into craft services. It really is just, what if a character in a movie became a character in a movie? This really helps to endear the shallowness to you a little bit more once you cotton to it, especially the fact that it was Michael Douglas cast as the generic Titan. Zodiac, 2007, review date April 27th, 2026, second viewing. Zodiac is primarily about the crimes investigators at the newspaper and in the various police departments, in the same way that JFK is primarily about the investigative team led by Jim Garrison. And this is powerful because in both cases, the investigation is a bottomless and terrifying thing that devours anyone who looks too deeply into it. So we best grasp the social meaning of the events by witnessing that devouring of the members of society closest to it. What makes this story so scary is that the facts aren't substantial enough to anchor them and explain the way they make us feel. It's not that the facts don't add up, it's that they're not enough. They tell us what happened, but nothing about why. The story of the Zodiac Killer feels like a cosmic vapor, like a cruel prank of the gods, and attempts to reckon with it force the reckoner to twist in the wind, aware with new keenness of how illusory society is and how little control we have over anything. The character's understanding of the situation changes so much and so fast, with so many dead ends and wrong turns and backups, that it starts to seem like the killer is everyone and no one. It's a very effective movie in this way, and makes for a rather fascinating contrast with Seven, because it's at once a far more and far less conventional serial killer mystery. It has a tenth of that movie's overt, stylish grisliness and forward drive, but those qualities are precisely what makes Seven unmistakably a movie. Its killer is all movied up, a proud, motivated, and impossibly meticulous psycho building carefully to a climax. The depth of the senseless void that Zodiac opens up to, the facelessness, half-competence, and attention hunger of this real killer makes it a scarier movie. Jake Gyllenhaal will never be convincing as a bookish little fellow or as somebody obsessed with anything other than himself, but he is plainly taking the assignment seriously and doing the best job he could have been expected to do here. That is the nicest thing I am capable of saying about him as an actor. Mark Ruffalo and Anthony Edwards are much more at home in their similar, schlubbier parts, and Robert Downey Jr. is always magnetic when he's doing this wonderfully pathetic kind of broken strutting. This is also one of the very first movies made after 2000 and set in the 60s and 70s that nails enough of the period details to be truly transportive, besides being one of the first digitally photographed movies to get anywhere near film textures. The Social Network, 2010. Review date, May 8th, 2026. Second viewing. Because Mark Zuckerberg exists, and is the way he is, and because he engineered the unprecedentedly nightmarish 21st century media age that he engineered, we sorely needed for him to get Citizen Kaned. It doesn't repair the damage he has done, but it's a comfort to be handed hard evidence that you're not the only one who sees him as a villain who would rather enact his petty miseries upon the planet than try to understand them. A juiced-up psychodramatization of one perspective it may be, but it is a powerfully compelling one, cutting a window into the woefully incomplete mind of the desperate teenager who rewired society as a competitive game so that he could award himself the most points, and aggressively interrogates the rest of us as to why we agreed to play along. It's as scathing as any Hollywood drama of the era, so scathing that it's honestly rather amazing it was made when it was. Facebook was far from over in 2010. Even though that was around when our parents were starting to join, social media still seemed fun. And it's very telling that nobody is shown having any fun with it in this movie. It's just something that becomes a new necessity one day. Fincher's chilled eyeballs see no upside, despite how funny the movie is. And my God, is it funny. Aaron Sorkin, for once, found something real and throbbing with pain to clamp his overactive wit down on. His humor is both the salt in the wound and the bandage over it. Just about every scene ends with a murderously good punchline, but threaded through each is this howling loneliness, the alien loneliness of Mark Zuckerberg, which was his gift to the world. The movie also looks ahead with remarkable keenness to the further splintering and decay and hatred that we came to know later in the decade and that are now worse than ever. Zuckerberg, this Zuckerberg anyway, is an incel. So if we gave control of our relations to an incel, why are we surprised that those were the kinds of voices that rose the highest in the aftermath? It's the definitive career highlight, not just for Sorkin, but for Fincher, who studies his subject like a curious zoologist, giving him the distance that he demands in both senses. There is genius in that shot of him outside the patio door while his team celebrates the milestone, a ghost looking in on the living. But the movie also counterbalances the man's pathetic sadness with a vengeful edge that makes him as frightening as any of Fincher's earlier serial killer characters. Indeed, fear seems like part of the reason for the distance. Perhaps less outlandishly, it's also a career highlight for Jesse Eisenberg, who perfectly captures Zuck's utter placelessness, a quality that reaches beyond aloofness or awkwardness into total non-personhood. Everything Zuck looks at appears both brand new and contemptible to him. So the movie looks at him that way. It's only fair. The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, 2008. Review date August 21st, 2020. First and only viewing. A smugly self-serious take on an oddball Fitzgerald story about a man who ages in reverse, beginning his life as a baby-sized old man in 1918 and ending it as an old baby in the early 2000s, on what is apparently some kind of fixed and predestined timeline, in the sense that if this were your situation, you'd have to imagine that once you started looking like, e.g., a 10-year-old, you would know that you had exactly 10 years to go. The problem is not that the film is too superficial to explore the premise that it sets up. On the contrary, it spends all of its 166 minutes poking into the emotional challenges that such a condition would provoke for our hero and everyone who loves him. The problem is that the premise doesn't hold itself together and isn't very interesting. None of those emotional challenges resonate, and the movie doesn't have any insights about humanity to draw up from this story, at least none any deeper than old people and little kids are alike in a lot of ways, and oh, how time does pass. Also, it never had any warmth, but David Fincher's style did once have something like an electricity, and all the watts have drained out of it by this point. I think he spent the very last of it on Zodiac. So what vitality there is in the story, he can't locate. It's an airless vault of a movie. What we end up with is a Forrest Gump for the 2000s. Unusual person who is also somehow an everyman takes us on a tour of American life in the 20th century, powered first by his love for his mother and then later for his sweetheart. You make this comparison in your head even before you see the credit that says screenplay by Eric Roth. This was also considered a major breakthrough for digital facial aging and de-aging effects, though by later standards it looks weird and choppy. The Killer, 2023, review date November 11th, 2023, first and only viewing. Like with a Bret Easton Ellis novel, all attempts to evaluate this must contend with a central and engulfing irony. Because it's David Fincher's most personal film, it's supposed to be his most superficial. Fincher is the movie world's answer to this assassin, the ultra-slick technician who does the job with stony, amoral acceptance, and who, even when things get personal, can only see his duty through by maintaining his frigid resolve. It's not so much a confessional as a professional. What works best are the thoughtful procedural details, into which are blended a multitude of grim jokes about how the depersonalization of transactions in the age of apps and gig work make a killer's job easier. The movie is at least a little ticklish along those lines. However, the jobs themselves, the hits, and especially the unimaginative revenge plot connecting them, are pretty gray stuff. Not only is there no depth, there's no real excitement either, save for the one meaningful fight scene, which does come through the screen, no smashed TV joke intended. Michael Fassbender keeps his mask on as instructed, so you can't attach. Le Samurai, I guess? But flatly aromantic instead of ironically romantic? And accordingly, you start to think you really are just meant to appreciate the craftsmanship and then forget everything 15 seconds after the credits roll. That's our Finchy. My theme music is by me and Johann Wagner. My logo design is by Aaron Robert Miller. Find these and more than 1,000 of my other reviews in writing at letterboxd.com/QUILLH. I'm Will Hatman, and I'll keep watching if you do.